Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the fastest growing and largest segment of society. To those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they've become counterproductive, and that there is no way to fix them. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion at any time over the next 3 hours, is 877-300-7645. I'd like to address a little bit of the Russian situation. It is principally caused by cascading oil prices. And oil is, around $60 a barrel. It was up well over $100 a barrel not long ago. And you wonder, okay, why is that the case? Did someone create enormous new capacity? No. You wonder, okay, so the United States investing in fracking, Canada investing in shale oil, Mexico getting their productivity together. No, those things are all based on a high oil price. Fracking and the American recovery of its once-thought lost oil reserves require a price near $100 to be effective. Shell oil, the shale oil recovery in Canada is a very expensive proposition. It doesn't work at $60 a barrel. There are two things that happen when oil comes to this level. One is that alternative forms of energy don't look promising anymore. It's the justification, the financial justification for building natural gas pipelines around the country to capitalize on that resource, the investment required to continue to make burning coal cleaner. Doesn't make sense economically. Wind generation is already marginal in terms of its utility, and it becomes even less viable as oil prices fall. Wind generation and solar, same thing. So you have to wonder, to what degree is this being done to keep the world dependent on the current power brokers? You have to ask yourself that. You know, yes, I know that Russia is the first casualty of this, and that's because Russia, unlike many of the original power brokers, has expensive extraction requirements. Their oil is in Siberia, where it's very expensive to extract it. It's in the North Sea, the Baltic, very expensive to extract it. It is around the Caspian Sea, not only expensive to extract it, but all of those require enormous investment in infrastructure and pipelines to transport the oil and gas. And so when the oil prices fall, the basis of the Russian economy falters because they don't have 25 cent a barrel extraction costs and negligible transportation costs. Both are very high. So you have to wonder, what's the future for American energy independence when oil prices plummet, which is if you were going to map out a plan to save America, you know, there's 1,000 things you'd have to do, but one of them would be to change our energy policy entirely and invest the money we squander in Social Security, Medicare, and the military in developing energy and developing energy independence. Well, that's not economically feasible at the present levels. So you wonder, is the United States a contributor to this at the highest levels? I mean, the United States inflicts fatal blows on itself all the time. The invasion of Afghanistan was a fatal blow. The invasion of Iraq, a fatal blow. The invasion of Vietnam, a fatal blow. And you say, well, we're still alive. We invaded Vietnam a long time ago. How is that a fatal blow? It's the consequence of Vietnam is still haunting us. as is Afghanistan, as is Iraq. They are deep gashes to our collective soul that are continuing to hemorrhage. Now, the reason for this current situation in oil is that the Saudi Arabians, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, all collectively decided that they would confront the problem America caused when it invaded Iraq and gave Iraq to Iran and empowered Iran and Shia Islam, that when they decided initially they would confront that with a proxy war and start arming Mujahideen in Syria, recruiting and arming them, and created al-Nusra. When that monster turned around, that snake, and started to bite them, they said, you know, I think we need a new plan. And then the United States exacerbated the problem even more when it started negotiating the Obama administration with Iran to legitimize its nuclear ambitions and gave Iran relief from sanctions. Then the Obama administration exacerbated the problem once again when they started slapping all sorts of sanctions on Russia, compelling Russia to increase its business dealings with Iran, creating the largest two trade transactions in modern history, both between Russia and Iran, both trading Iranian oil for Russian products. This further empowered the Iranians in Shia Islam. So the Saudi Arabians, either independently or with paying others to think for them, came up with a plan. And that's the plan that we're seeing materialize before our eyes. Now, I haven't read this anywhere. I have no verification of this. I'm just looking at the overall scene, recognizing what is known and knowable, what has been said, what has been done, understanding the history between Shia and Sunni Islam, and simply thought it through. In the past, oil prices were not allowed to plunge because Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates et al. Lowered production. And they lowered production so that the surplus of oil would not drive down prices because there would be no surplus. This time they're not doing that. So you have to ask yourself, why haven't they done that? This is the first time they haven't done that. And, you know, OPEC has been manipulating as a monopoly the price of oil since the 1960s. It's coterminous, by the way, with the rise of fundamentalist Islamic terrorism. It's the fuel for Islamic terrorism. So we should be really concerned about this. So I began to think, why would they do that? Well, first of all, I came to realize that Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, et al. Aren't countries. Their personal estates. The infrastructure in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, for example, was stolen. There's no investment in it. You know, the original investment was paid by American and British firms, and it was stolen by the thugs, the Muslims that are the dictators over Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So they have no cost in their infrastructure, and they have no meaningful distribution costs. The Arabian Peninsula, while a desert, while having no value whatsoever, is surrounded by water. It's easy for them to distribute the water. So the oil. So they really have no cost. They make a bundle of money at $60 a barrel. Cost them somewhere around 25 cents a barrel to extract and take the oil to port. So at $60 a barrel, you know, to fund a private estate, they're rolling in the money. But other countries aren't. So since they were unable to thwart Iran and its expansion of power through Iraq, through Syria, through Lebanon, with the help of the United States was counterproductive. The Obama administration has constantly sided with Iran and empowered Iran. Since they weren't able to do it by starting a proxy war, like America did in Afghanistan, using the Taliban and Al-Qaeda against Russia, this time using the same kind of jihadists, but against the Shia government of Syria, since that turned on them and started to bite them, this was the logical response. Drive down oil prices. If oil prices plummet, then Iran, whose economy is completely based on oil, whose recent lifting of sanctions by Obama, and whose business dealings with Russia have empowered them to complete their nuclear ambitions, the only way to thwart that now is to preclude them from selling oil at a price that will enable that economy to recover. This is all being done by and with the consent of the United States and the knowledge of the United States, orchestrated by Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, for the express purpose of driving down the price of oil as an economic war against Iran. And Russia, who is an ally of Iran, is a consequence of that war. Now, you might say, oh, well, who cares about what happens with Russia? Who cares, you know, if it hurts Iran, so be it. And you may not appreciate the consequence of this to the hope of a sane energy policy in the United States. But there are consequences of this. The Russian economy cannot falter alone. The Russian economy will drag Europe down with it. The European economy will not falter alone with Russia. It will drag the American economy down with it. We will enter a worldwide recession as a result of all of this manipulation, all as a direct result of America invading Iraq, giving Iraq to Iran, artificially empowering Shia Islam, and causing Sunni Muslims to respond. That is the mess we find ourselves in. Speaking of consequence, Switzerland's national bank, that would be the central bank of Switzerland, is now bringing forth a negative interest rate, cutting the value of large sums of money on deposit in the country. A negative interest rate. For this is a minus 0.25% interest. Now you might think, what? So rather than being given interest on depositing your money in a Swiss bank, the value of your principal doesn't appreciate, it depreciates. Now, the reason for this, they say, is that because of the devaluation of the ruble, too many people have transferred their currency into the Switzerland franc, the Swiss franc. And in so doing, what they have done is driven up the value of the Swiss franc. And so the Swiss want to push down the value of their currency. If their value of their currency is too high, nothing that is made in Switzerland can be sold anywhere else in the world. And products made outside of Switzerland can be bought at an unfair price compared to those made in Switzerland. So the Swiss have actually decided that on any bank account of $10 million or more, 10 million Swiss francs, it's 9.77 million U.S. dollars or more, to ding those savings by accepting a fee, if you will, rather than paying the people for the deposits, they're going to take a fee for having the currency in their banks. Now that is an amazing situation. You know, that's almost like a plan, and maybe it is a foreshadow of a plan that we will see in a much more dramatic way worldwide. One day, we may find that the powers that be in a fascist system will decide that they can empower themselves by blaming the economic crisis that they themselves imposed on the rich, saying that the rich have stolen your money, they're greedy, they don't need as much as they have, and they'll apply negative interest rates to any accounts in America, probably over $1 million. And rather than minus 0.25, they'll make it minus 25%. And they just will confiscate people's savings. And they will then tell you they're going to redistribute the wealth, and some of it they'll redistribute, making people more dependent, destroying their character, destroying all incentive to work. And the economy will get worse, and they'll say, well, you know, the problem is we didn't take enough, and they'll take more. And pretty soon, there won't be anyone who has the financial wherewithal to oppose them, and everyone will be either destitute or dependent, or a combination of both. It's a marvelous way to control people economically. Yesterday, we ended our news portion of the program talking about what was happening with Israel and how the Muslim thugs in the West Bank Gaza, Hamas, and the Palestinian Liberation Organization collectively have decided that they want a terrorist state. They want a state that is specifically designed to empower terrorists. Now, the reason they want a state is that as a state, they will receive the opportunity to build weapons that can continue to menace Israel. I mean, that's the only reason they want to stay. No other reason. I mean, the Palestinian Authority, since it was concocted out of the PLO by Bill Clinton, has been an absolute unmitigated failure. So is Hamas. And yet you've got the European Union deciding that Hamas is no longer a terrorist organization. If they're not a terrorist organization, there are no terrorist organizations. And that collectively they want to reward these thugs with their own state, and the thugs want the state for a singular reason. It precludes Israel from putting a weapons embargo around them. And right now, the West Bank functions independently. Gaza functions independently. Israel's only influence over them is to run blockades that prevent them from receiving the supplies of advanced weapons they would like. And, of course, their weapons would be used only to terrorize Israel for no other purpose. So this is a really bad idea of which no good will come. So we continue this article. Shortly before leaving Rome, we find that Netanyahu, who is in the middle of a re-election campaign, it's always in the middle of a re-election campaign in the parliamentary system. Personally, I think the parliamentary system is among the worst government systems ever conceived. And the reason is, and Israel is a prime example, is that the people really don't vote for their representatives. They vote for parties. And those parties then, in caucus, choose their representatives. And then to form a government, since it's very seldom, unless you're in an Islamic country where elections are a fraud, a farce, you're very seldom do you have a party with a majority. So what has to happen is that the party that received the most votes has to find a way to encourage, would be the polite term, bribe would be the more accurate term, smaller parties that received a lot fewer votes even than the second place party, to ally with them. It's the way that Israel became so screwed up with the religious party, with the Shahs, with the Black Hats, where they would, where they were a minority, typically about 15%, but they would side with whoever would give them the best deal. And the best deal was precluding them from having to serve in the Israeli Defense Forces, providing them with a stipend to be religious, and allowing them to indoctrinate their children in rabbinic schools. And so they received all sorts of benefits, so that it bribed, if you will, to vote in favor of, to throw their 15% of seats in with the majority. And so what it creates is this, these partnerships that are born out of bribery, bad system. But anyway, so Netanyahu is always running for office, so it's that information is not germane to this article, shouldn't have been said. It says, we will not accept attempts to dictate unilateral time-bound moves to us. I will say these things in the clearest manner. Even if there are dictates, we will stand up to them firmly. So it's telling that shitty little country, Great Britain, I use that term because that's the way they refer to Israel, France, Italy, Germany, that if they, even the United States, chooses to vote in favor of the ultimate pariah, the Muslim terrorists of the PLO and Hamas, and award these terrorists a state, that Israel's going to say, screw you. You're, you know, you can play with your words all you want, but no, we're not going to do this. And it's suicide for Israel to do it. You know, appeasing belligerent, ruthless people is always a bad idea. We tried this before World War II with giving Hitler Czechoslovakia. When you try to make a state out of a cadre of people who have a propensity for thievery and dishonesty and for militancy and immorality, as was the case in Ukraine, complete failed state, as is the case with the West Bank and Gaza, you have no chance of success. You're creating a pariah. And so it has no chance of success. It's not going to appease the Muslims. And all that the grant of statehood to these Muslims of the PLO and Hamas is going to do is to allow them to amass weaponry at the place where Israel would now be about 10 miles wide, where 70% of its population lives. It will cause Israel to be indefensible. So there's nothing positive that can be gained and a great deal that can be lost, including pointing a finger right in God's eye. Strategic Affairs Minister Steinez said Israel expected Washington to use its Security Council veto, but that's not necessarily so, because even though America has in the past done this, the Abominator is an entirely different kind of individual. He is a Muslim sympathizer. France is also leading a bid among Europeans to draft a resolution with a less definitive timetable before Israel's March 17th election. A Western diplomat said that Europeans felt the United States was now open to that possibility. Yeah, the Abominator is a very different kind of individual. America has joined the forces of evil regarding Israel. Israeli-Palestinian peace talks championed by Kerry collapsed in April. That's because Kerry wanted to impose this very thing. And he was telling Israel, you either accept the imposition of a Palestinian state or you will be ostracized from the world. A Gaza war last summer, heightened violence in recent weeks in Israel and the West Bank, and Israel election campaign have all dampened prospects that talks will soon resume. You know, when you terrorize those that you're trying to encourage to treat you honorably. You're trying to elicit a concession from people you're terrorizing. Chances are it's going to work as well as eliciting a heartfelt, credible confession from somebody you're torturing. UN Middle East Peace Process Envoy Robert Seri briefed the Security Council on Monday and said that any resolution outlining the parameters of an Israeli-Palestinian final status agreement would be important, but, quote, not a substitute for a genuine peace process that will need to be negotiated between both parties. You know, Robert, I'm sure you can read. I'm sure that you can open historical and journalistic accounts of every offer, every deal, every negotiation between the PLO and Israel, between Hamas and Israel. I'm sure you can read the PLO's charter. I'm sure you can read Hamas's charter. I'm sure that you can look at the history of Muslims and Israel. And I'm certain that you will find an asymmetrical threat. Asymmetrical morality. I'm sure that you will find the only thing that can be found, that you can't negotiate with a Muslim. I'm sure that you can read the ninth surah of the Quran. I'm sure that you can come to realize that in Islam, a treaty between Muslims and non-Muslims is not binding on the Muslims, and therefore it is a complete and utter waste of time to negotiate with a Muslim. That's what the Quran says. The Quran is the ultimate authority within Islam. This is not open to interpretation, Robert. Think it through. The Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, hopes that the Security Council action will generate constructive momentum towards the creation of a meaningful and effective framework for renewed negotiations. Such a move by the Secretary of the Security Council would constitute a major step in this conflict, Seri said. So both of them want the United Nations to impose on Israel a time certain to give these terrorist thugs who have proven that they are immoral, irresponsible, vicious, counterproductive, wholly dependent parasites, their own state. And that's a good thing, according to the United Nations. I shared a comment on this earlier, but I want to get into the detail. A top court of the European Union, which has become really a force for evil in the world, has annulled the bloc's decision to keep the Palestinian Islamist movement, Hamas, on a list of terrorist groups. You know, if you are so jaundiced that you're a judge and you don't recognize that Hamas fires rockets at civilians when it promises not to do so, that Hamas hides its rockets in schools and at hospitals and in apartment complexes to terrorize its own people, that Hamas enslaves its own people to dig tunnels so that it can terrorize civilians in Israel using kidnap, and that Hamas has used terror tactics and celebrated terror tactics, has publicly proclaimed that terrorists, its own terrorists, who have murdered Israelis are heroes. That this organization, they're saying, is not a terrorist organization. If Hamas isn't a terrorist organization, then for God's sake, the Islamic State isn't a terrorist organization. If Hamas isn't a terrorist organization, then Boko Haram isn't a terrorist organization. If Hamas isn't a terrorist organization, then Al-Qaeda isn't a terrorist organization. Nor is Al-Shabaab. There are no terrorist organizations if Hamas is not one. The decision had been based upon an examination of Hamas's actions but on, not on, it says not on an examination of Hamas's actions. No, we would not want to look at Hamas's behavior to determine whether they were engaged in the behavior of terrorism. But on factual imputations derived from the press and the internet. So these judges did not look at Hamas's behavior. What is terrorism? It's a behavior. But instead, on factual imputations derived from the press and the internet. So they're saying that the press and the internet are a source of facts. And I would beg to differ. That's why we spend the first 2 hours of this program lampooning the accuracy of the press. And so they reviewed and the imputations that can be derived from the press and the internet. The court said that the move was tactical and not a reinstatement of Hamas's classification of a terrorist group. It says the funding freeze on the group would continue for the time being. Hamas dominates Gaza. By the way, a funding freeze. Good grief. The European Union and the United States, and as well as other countries in the world, recently gave Hamas $6 billion as a reward for their war against Israel. $6 billion they handed Hamas. That's a funding freeze in their perspective. Hamas dominates Gaza. It actually would dominate the West Bank, too, and in the last election, in fact, the only really free election that that the Muslims in Israel have had, Hamas won somewhere between two-thirds and 70% of the votes. And Hamas is, you know, devoted to the destruction of Israel. This article says Hamas dominates Gaza and fought a 50-day war with Israel early this year. Under its charter, the movement is committed to Israel's destruction. Now, can you imagine being a judge in Europe and saying, you know, I think I want to legitimize a group that uses terror as a tactic, as their principal tactic, that is committed to the destruction of a sovereign nation. I mean, that is so far beyond reasonable, rational, moral, appropriate, civil, just, that you have to shake your head and say, what in the hell happened to us? I mean, how could humanity have become that depraved? How could humanity have become that thoughtless? That's stupid. Here are educated individuals who have been indoctrinated in political correctness that have come to hate Israel so much that they're willing to run cover for. They're willing to stand beside. They're willing to hold up and exonerate, to legitimize one of the most ruthless terrorist organizations in the world. The one that has the most blood on its hands. The one who can't be trusted with any agreement. The one who is the most prone to starting wars. The one whose very charter calls for the destruction of a sovereign nation. And they're going to side with it in a judicial institution. That is how far humanity has fallen. You know, when Yahweh told us that he needed to start again with a clean slate with human beings, with a nesama. Nesama is our conscience. It's something that Yahweh gave uniquely to humankind. It's the only thing that differentiates humans, other than our upright nature, from other animals. And he recognized that the humans with a nesama were not using their conscience for good, but for evil. It became a really conniving lot. And about 1,000 years after Adam and Chawa had been expelled from the garden, we find God so distraught with humankind that evil had become so abundant, that mankind had become so depraved, that God said, you know, I need to start over again. And he found Noah, his family, put them on the ark and saved them. Now, real story, by the way. The metaphorical implications are profound, and what it means as it relates to foreshadowing the covenant that Yahweh would create with us, and the Ark of the Covenant as it pertains to the means that Yahweh uses to save and empower and enrich his children. But it's an event that actually occurred. It didn't occur worldwide. It occurred from Mesopotamia all the way from Ur of the Chaldeans, Babylon, all the way up through the Black Sea. Evidence for it is ubiquitous, undeniable. And so God realized that humankind had reached that point. We find another reference to humankind being wholly and completely depraved in Sodom and Gomorrah. And we even have some insights into the behavior in Sodom and Gomorrah that was, in their case, violent and sexual perversion. Sexual assault. Now, if you go forward again about 400 years, you find Yahweh saying that the degradation, the iniquity, the depravity of those occupying some half a dozen or so villages and towns in the Promised Land had reached the point that there was no hope for them, that they needed to be eradicated from the home of Yahweh's children. So just as you would rid a home of bubonic and plague-infected rats before you would allow your family to move in, you'd rid it of poisonous and venomous animals. We'll be back.